This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. It is Sunday, and the main course is every Sunday from 12 to 1-ish on Heritage Radio Network. We're incredibly pleased and flattered to be sponsored today by Roberta's, right here where we're broadcasting from, Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I just had the most delicious dish of polenta with a fried egg and porchetta. And actually, they called it polenta, but really, to me, it was coarse yellow grits, slow-cooked the way they're supposed to be, nice and mellow. Today, my guests for the whole hour are Michael Hurwitz, director of the Green Market,
yep,
and Liz Carolla, who does the events there.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in, you guys. Sure. It's always great to have you.
Thanks for having us
back. Liz, I want to do it all the time. I mean, I think we should have like a little update about the Green Market, you know, about every 4 to 6 weeks. Good to check in, let people know what's going on as the seasons change, what's coming into the Green Market, what kind of programs are we, you know, promoting, what kinds of events are you sponsoring, and then we can talk some of the politics around the Green Market, too, because that'll be fun.
Great.
So with Thanksgiving like right on our doorstep here, you guys must be incredibly busy. I'm sure farmers are like stacked to the rafters.
Best time of year.
Yeah. It is. And it's also the busiest time of year.
Yeah.
This Wednesday at Union Square will be the literally, we'll have about 70,000 people walk through that market.
Holy
and
Toledo.
And it's when we squeeze everybody in that we can for that last opportunity to get the shopper in and also get the product. Like, this is when the most product is here.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is the end of the growing season and people are, you know, all of the squashes are hard. All the hard squashes are coming in.
Yep.
You have cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, broccoli.
Yeah.
What
else? And actually, well, the irony is that it's been warm.
Yeah.
And beautiful greens where people thought that it might be time to, you know, disc the field is, actually, there are gorgeous greens that are in the market now.
Fabulous. You mean like collard greens?
Yeah, lots of greens.
People were, actually, some of the farmers were shocked that they were actually going to have a few more weeks of being able to come in. The warmth preserved some of the, even like the carrots and the other root crops that they might have otherwise said, hey, our fields are done. And, but no, they're still pulling things out.
We haven't had a hard frost yet.
It's pretty
at
amazing.
Least not down in this area. I suspect probably farther north up in the Cambridge area or something.
It's definitely. And there have been. And it means that the Brussels sprouts are tasty and the collards are sweet.
Fabulous. So what are people going to see? I see a lot of cauliflower just in my local West Side Market. So that's obviously a big crop right now. It looks really good. I'm going to do something with cauliflower in the next couple weeks in my cooking class.
Yeah.
So.
It's beautiful. And all colors.
Right.
Which,
yeah,
which I love.
Purple,
I love the purple and the cheddar cauliflowers.
Yeah, they're really pretty.
Brussels sprouts, lots of the winter squashes are in.
Yeah. You guys still have delicata?
Oh yeah,
that's one of my favorites.
Delicious.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah,
me
I love
too.
That. You can even eat the
and
skin.
And the kabocha.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I do eat the skin of the delicatas.
Yeah,
right. That's the best part.
It is the best part, right?
Yeah, if you cut it small.
You know who taught me how to cook that was Bill Telepan. He made it for, I forget what, it was like some recipe he was giving for a magazine or something. And it was just like, oh, wow. Oh, it was in a Bon Appetit spread, I think, that he did. And and he did it with a pomegranate molasses and fresh pomegranate seeds. And he just fried the slices of delicata in olive oil. And it was absolutely sensational.
Sounds
really
good.
Nice.
Make
really
today.
Simple. Yeah, it was so simple. And it was so beautiful.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's built for you. What are you
exactly.
Gonna do?
I think traditionally all of your Thanksgiving ingredients are at the market this week.
How about celery root?
Cranberries.
Lots of celery
lots
root.
Of
Jerusalem artichokes.
Celery root is one of my favorite vegetables. And I think it's one of the most underused vegetables, especially in the wintertime.
It's a little scary to look at if you're not familiar with it.
It is.
So.
I actually had no idea what it was.
Really?
Until I started this job.
Uh-huh.
And showed up one day to the 57th Street Market, and our manager was making mashed celeriac.
Yeah.
I was like, what is that? And tasted it. I'm sold.
Oh,
and
it's brilliant.
It's what my 20-month-old son has grew up on last winter.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Can't get enough.
It's great stuff.
It's phenomenal.
I like to braise it with a little bit of bacon and apple cider. You cut it into cubes and saute those for a few minutes in the bacon grease and then throw it in the oven with a cup of cider and cover it up and it gets soft and kind of...
Is there anything that's not good with a little bit of bacon?
I was about to say, I think that's how I cook every vegetable.
Especially all these heavy winter greens are just so great with a little piece of bacon or pancetta. I mean, there's just nothing better than that.
It's time to put on a little fat for the winter. Keep us warm throughout, right?
We like to call that recession cooking.
And we have a lot of recipes. We don't typically have recipes available on our website, but my coworker Tara LaRufa, who runs programming at Union Square, collected recipes from volunteers and staff and farmers, all of their favorite Thanksgiving recipes. So there's something like 30 or 40 on our website now from the farmers, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And holiday cookbooks at market.
Right.
People can grab.
Yeah. Oh, that's fabulous.
Yeah. Most of the markets, the managers have put together Thanksgiving recipe packets for people to pick up. So,
So rush Wednesday. Right on down. Maybe not on Wednesday, though.
Right.
Is the market open on Tuesday? No.
Not Union Square, but
other markets.
Many of our markets that are open Thursday or Friday typically will be rescheduled for Tuesday or Wednesday this week. So
like,
that's
where
listed
would those
on our site.
Be?
On our website. On
your site. So if you go to the CENYC.
Markets like Columbia, Market 97th Street, City Hall.
Uh-huh.
All of those markets will be shifted from either the Friday or Thursday of Thanksgiving
to the Tuesday
or Wednesday.
So that people can get all their stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I recommend going on Tuesday. I mean, everybody does seem to wait until Wednesday to pick up all their stuff. And I know, years ago when I worked in a butcher shop on the Upper West Side, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving was the very worst. It was the biggest moneymaker day.
Right.
It was the very worst day of the year to be in retail. From our point of view, the line would be out the door. It was from 8 in the morning until 8 at night. It was hundreds of hysterical people who, if your turkey was 6 ounces over or under the weight you had ordered, it was cause for great consternation. Curses would fly. And the people who owned the shop, the woman, Eleanor, who I adore, it was not the greatest at public relations. Her customer relations profile was really low. And if somebody got mad at her, she would just get really pissed. It would be like practically fisticuffs.
That's what makes New York so special.
It's like Black Wednesday for the food world.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's right. It's really rough. So, get your shopping done early, folks. I think it's better.
Definitely. Yeah, for sure.
And, we have 19 markets that'll be open year-round.
Now, that's an exciting development. You were saying before we came into the studio that you were thinking things would slow down for you a little bit after Thanksgiving, but no,
right.
Huh?
Yeah. We have, of the 49 markets, probably about 22 will close this week.
Mm-hmm.
Another 10 or so close over the next month. Mm-hmm. And then we'll have 19 of our markets operating year-round. And, of course, they get smaller.
Yeah.
And what's available changes.
Well, you'll still have things like poultry, eggs, because those are year-round products.
Oh, sure. Maple syrup, dry beans.
Maple syrup.
Yeah.
Oh, dried beans. Yep. I've never bought dried beans in the market.
Cayuga Pure Organics, they joined the program this year. They're from Ithaca.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm. Lots of dry beans and some
flour. But they're not the only ones. We've had cranberry beans in the market for years.
Yes.
We've had Franca Tantillo bringing her beans in.
Bill Maxwell.
And Bill Maxwell at Grand Army. So,
and you'll have cheeses and cider, apples. Those seem to all go through the season.
Yeah, lots of root vegetables, storage crops still coming in for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, as we were saying, the growing season has been so unusually long this year because we've had such a mild fall.
Oh, my coworker my boss came bursting in the other day, Sabine, and said, "You know what is awful about global warming? We're all going to start having to work all winter.
We're going to shift
our
season.
Our markets are going to open.
The season is just going to shift." But, what we were talking about before with the greens, when I grew food in Red Hook, it added value in the Red Hook farm.
Yeah.
2 years ago, early February, I think we were harvesting.
Wow.
Yeah. And,
That's wild.
Yeah. So it's not just what's
grown
in the
greenhouses.
But
that's container garden, too. Aren't those all raised beds?
They are.
So
but no plastic. And that's the other thing, is that more and more farmers are learning about season extension.
Yeah,
and how they can get a few more months, of production out of their fields, and it's crucial, particularly in this year, in this economy, the way farmers have gotten hammered, It's crucial. Because
the summer was a brutal season for them.
And then also the value-added products. It's why processing is such an important... You talked about the politics that we'll get into, but the need for infrastructure and processing facilities is so crucial because it allows farmers to extend their seasons by creating those value-added products. And in doing so, it also creates jobs here downstate and green jobs at that. So there are ways to really think about bringing in more income over the winter and having more product available for New Yorkers.
And the way to really do that, it seems to me, I mean, one of the things that comes up over and over again whenever whenever I read anything that's, say, in the cattle industry or even other sort of, I don't know, industries that are a little more sort of dinosaurish, everybody talks about the elitist quality of, you know, buying things at the green market. It's so much more expensive, blah, blah, blah. And the thing is that if everybody participated in buying, then the farmers would know how much money they're going to have in any given season, more or less. They could take out, you know, they could start building more infrastructure on their farms in the way of greenhouses or ways to grow things like strawberries in January, which we normally fly in from, you know, Chile or whatever. And the prices would come down because the more volume, the more people you're supporting, the more supply there is and the more supply, right? Am I crazy?
No, you're not crazy at all. But I'm going to address the affordability issue.
Yeah, let's.
We've been working closely with the District Public Health Office in the South Bronx.
Uh-huh.
And our markets that are in the South Bronx are less expensive or the same price as the bodegas and the supermarkets in those neighborhoods.
Mm.
And when you factor in value and quality, it makes it more affordable because you end up throwing away less than what you would if you bought the food at the
supermarket.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because you're not buying something that's already half dead.
We've done the same thing in other neighborhoods throughout the city. And when you compare apples to apples, they really do cost the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Industrially produced protein is cheaper than pasture-raised, healthy meats.
Yes.
And it will always be, particularly if it remains subsidized by the government.
Yes.
And the subsidy is not just on the front end with the feed. It's also with the environmental cleanup and the health impact that those products have on society. So actually, when you factor in cost and affordability and you look at the big picture, I actually think that if we flip the value question and said, what are we going to invest in from a policy standpoint?
Right.
And you invested in agriculture and really health and wellness, I think you'd find that it would be more affordable.
Mm-hmm.
Farmers would be making more money. We'd have a healthier citizenry as well as a healthier planet. So affordability, you know, there's a lot of gray in that issue. But you're also right, is that if farmers knew that income was coming in and they knew that there was a steady stream and could plan for that and that there were different types of season extension, that I think food would be less expensive. But food, there's a reason why food costs what it costs, whether it's in the supermarket or whether it's at the farmer's market. And I do think that there are many deals to be had at the market. I think actually once when we were here, we talked about how to find a deal, end of days.
Right. Shop around,
shop in season. Go to a farmer.
I went to one stand and bought cabbage at $3.50 a pound one day and walked to the next stand and it was 50 cents a pound and I was kicking myself. You just have to shop around. It depends what you're looking for. Yeah. And the New Yorker this week is all about food. And there's a comic in there about the farmer's market and, you know, talking about it, you know, goes into the whole elitist thing, just this little comic. And I was like, that's not true. You can find affordable food.
But that is the public perception. And I think that just as industrial agriculture needs a public relations facelift, so does the green market in the sense of...
It does. Actually, there was a round table at NYU on Friday where this was... I wasn't there... Other people were talking about us and the image. And some of what people thought is that, you know, we now operate one of the largest food stamp and farmers market programs in the country.
Right.
And that's since 2005. And I think since I've been here, we've really been able to ramp that up. And a lot of that is because of the Council on the Environment Executive Director, Marcel Van Uyen, his emphasis on having green market and the council be a real resource for health. And whether that health is around green markets or youth markets or senior markets or the Learn It, Grow It, Eat It program that our sister organizations operate in the South Bronx. And yet, you know, our focus is really leveling the playing field. And what people think is that, oh, this is recent, green market is recently getting into this. You know, Union Square wasn't a nice place when the farmers market started there.
No kidding, man.
Washington Heights, 175th Street Market has been there over 10 years.
Wow.
You know, Poe Park, South Bronx. We've been in lower income communities for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And food is not about, our markets are not about elitism. We have, now there are products that sell for $7 a pound for meat.
Yeah.
$48 a pound for microgreens.
Yeah.
There's also $2 a pound spinach, $1 a pound spinach, 50 cents a head, you know, cabbage.
A pound cabbage,
and
yeah.
Everything in between. And there is something at every market for everybody that's accessible, that's affordable. And then when we begin working with programs like the Department of Health and Mental Health Health Buck program, where we give a $2 health buck for every $5 that's spent using food stamps, that's a 40% boost in
that's
buying
a
power.
Lot. Yeah.
So we really are trying to make healthy food, locally grown, healthy food, affordable and accessible by all New Yorkers.
Uh-huh.
And you're right. We need to do a better job of spreading the word. I think we do a great job of operating markets. And, you know, when you have limited resources,
right,
it's opportunities like this to talk to the public to say, hey, listen, this is not what we're about. Come to a market. Check it out. You have family-friendly events, individual-friendly events. You're going to learn something. You're going to have a good time. You're going to taste something delicious.
Yes.
And you're going to leave with good, healthy, valuable product.
How do you think the Jack is telling me we have a break in 2 minutes. That's good because we have to remember to mention our sponsor. But how do you think the political climate has changed in terms of the farmers market? Like with the new Secretary of Agriculture, with the new administration, and the big emphasis, you know, that the Obamas have made on, you know, healthy eating and planting the garden and all that kind
right.
of stuff. Do you feel like that is going to really trickle out into any place other than sort of big urban centers like this?
It has already. Well, yeah.
Really?
Oh, sure. I mean, my parents live in the suburbs and now send me clippings from their local paper about farms and gardening. And
right. But I don't think that's because of the administration. I'll tell you, I think that Michelle Obama planting a garden had a huge impact because I think it shows to everybody, anybody can do this.
Yeah.
If you listen to Secretary Vilsack, and he tells you, I have two sons. I have industrial ag, and I have sustainable ag.
Yeah.
And I love them both.
Yeah.
And I think that while that's, you know, it's great that finally a Secretary of Agriculture says that sustainable ag is one of their children.
Too. Right.
And it does have a significant impact. And some of the folks who have been hired are tremendous. And let's see in a year or two actually what happens. And I'll give Obama that opportunity.
Yeah.
But industrial ag is always going to be more powerful. It's always going to be the focus. They're the lobby. And so I think we have to see, because if we truly want to impact the health of our country and from an environmental and community and health perspective, big ag can't be part of that they have to change their ways if they're going to be part of that solution.
That's, I think. Jack, why don't we take a break here, and we're going to come back to that very topic in just a minute or two. And we're back. This is The Main Course. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and my co-host, Patrick, is still on the road counting turkeys. This is obviously his big, busy season. Patrick will be back with us next week. And he should be phoning in actually in about 10 minutes or so for a little report on the turkey business out in Kansas City, which is where his birds are processed and then shipped to all four corners of the United States. But this is Heritage Radio Network. This is The Main Course. We are in Roberta's Restaurant, and we are sponsored today by Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Best wood-fired pizza, and oh boy, did I have some groovy grits today. It was great. So in the studio, we have Michael Hurwitz from The Green Market and Liz Carolla, also from The Green Market, the event director, and Michael, who is the director. And we were just talking about industrial agriculture versus sustainable agriculture. And I think that the adversarial positions of those two groups is not necessarily to the advantage of either of them or to any of us. And I think that what I wanted to pursue with you a little bit, Michael, was what are the things that, I mean, industrial agriculture is a big boat and it's not going to want to turn too much.
No.
But they're going to have to because consumers are going to force it. And that's what's happening now. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely.
And so what can industrial, what are the things that industrial, because let's face it, we got a lot of people in this country to feed. Industrial agriculture does have a role to play. I mean, they obviously have a big role to play here because we can't, I mean, I don't think we can grow enough food on small farms. So we are going to have to grow some big, big commodity crops. What are the things that could change about how those crops are grown that you think would be sort of dovetail more into the whole sort of issues around sustainability and environmental controls?
That's a big question. And I will tell you that even within Green Market, we have discussions about what is big, what does big mean, and what is small.
Uh-huh.
What's industrial, what's commercial, what's non-commercial. And I think that the best way that I can answer this question is what do I think agriculture should look like, regardless of scale?
Okay.
And I think that it has to promote biodiversity.
Yes.
That we have to limit the use of synthetic fertilizers. And
that, I think, is probably the biggest.
Yeah.
That would be the biggest step, right?
Yes.
Because ultimately, to me, the biggest issues that face our country and actually around the world is water. And I don't think anybody is thinking that 10 or 15 or 20 years ahead of the game here. But the water issues, the fact that the industrial runoff, which they are absolutely bound and determined to completely deny that they have any impact on the
waterways. Two-thirds of the water pollution in the States
is from industrial, whether it's right. A CAFO, a confined area feeding operation, or whether it is the fertilizer runoff.
That's right.
From big cornfields in Iowa or whatever.
Right. So,
but in order to do that, you have to diversify.
You have to diversify what you grow. And you have to, you talked about, small farms feed our population?
Yes. What do you think
about that? And part of what we're also talking about is food for export, because our big agriculture producers also export around the world.
They certainly do.
And I think what Green Market is about and what we support about a sustainable food system globally are local solutions for feeding populations. And I think globally that's what should be promoted, and I think locally that's what should be promoted. And where local farms are not, I mean, listen, I eat food that's not produced locally.
Sure.
And I always will. And you just have to know, I think the role is to educate the public about how to make smart food choices. And those food choices can be, I know that this is not available to me locally. Where can I get it from that will support, again, from a values-based perspective, the economy of that region, the health of that region, and the health of the people who are growing that product.
Right. So when you want to buy raspberries in January, then you know that they're going to be coming in from Chile.
Right.
And is that going to be a good thing or a bad thing for those Chilean farmers?
Right. And it depends on how it's grown.
Right.
Whether the money goes into those farmers' pockets or somebody else's pockets, and how those local communities are being invested in. And that's why, you know, what we do, what Green Market does, we know that there's not a local grain industry.
Right.
That it's been basically decimated through consolidation, and that's the reality right now. What we're implementing, our season goes from April 1 to March 31st. So we're current March 31st, 2010 is when this current season ends. Mm-hmm. Starting April 1st, 2010, we're going to require our bakers to be using at least 15% local grains.
Hmm.
We think that's a realistic, attainable number, that it can support, that will help build momentum for more grain being produced in the region.
Uh-huh.
And who knows, maybe 5 years from now, it'll be 100% that we require in local grain. But right now, the mills don't exist, and the growers don't exist, particularly after a wet, tough year like this one. Even some of our numbers may have been reduced, but we still think it's an attainable goal. I know that I eat things from all over. But again, I want to know that I'm supporting something with my food dollar. Your food dollar, every time you spend your dollar on food, you're making a social and environmental and an economic decision. It's a powerful food dollar.
Yes, it is.
And again, I know that sometimes I eat chicken wings watching a football game that my Lord don't want to know.
And
I'll repent all week.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of gray in these issues. But I do think that there are steps that our government can take to support research. The research dollars that are available for both organic or even things like IPM or certified naturally grown, there are ways that from a policy perspective, that we can invest differently. You know, we were talking before about the health buck program. Yes. Let me tell you what the health bucks are. Health bucks is a program that was created by the Department of Health and Mental Health. It's a $2 coupon, can only be used on fresh fruits and vegetables. And in New York City, it's in three catchment areas. It's the three catchment areas that have the highest rates of diet-related illnesses. It's uh-huh. the South Bronx, Central Brooklyn, and East and Central Harlem. And it started off, there were $15,000 total available for the city, and I think that was 2006. And I think there's now about $250,000, give or take. Not a lot of money, but making significant impact in what our low-income neighbors are able to shop for.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes a significant, we know that when someone shops at a farmer's market, they have a higher intake of fresh fruits and vegetables daily. We know that. Quantitative analysis has been done there, it's been backed up, supported. We know that that happens. And when you can create programs like those to make it possible for everyone to shop at farmer's markets, it really does have an impact on health. Well, I think there could be a national health buck program. And not
I'm
just
surprised there isn't
not and not just means tested,
right?
Doesn't have to be for the poorest. What if our health insurance companies, as an incentive for us to go shop at a farmer's market, or at least support healthy foods?
Well, so you must have seen Michael Pollan's editorial about how the health once the, if we have industry, you know, public health option,
mm-hmm.
and insurance companies have a vested interest in maintaining the health of the population,
right.
then they are going to have a vested interest in changing the way our foods are produced.
That's right.
But we have Patrick on the phone right now, Jack, right? So bring him up. Patrick?
Hey, guys. How are you? What's up?
Ahoy there.
What's up?
we should ask the same of you, Patrick. Where are you right now?
I am actually trying to get to Lydia's Kansas City, a restaurant, as quickly as possible. And in fact, I know this is inappropriate to use your research team for such purposes. But Jack, if I'm leaving Leawood, could you just make sure that Leawood, Kansas, is east of Kansas City? Leawood. 435 west. Oh, my God. I have to get there fast, too.
I see, anyway, I see Jack Googling.
I'm in town for turkeys.
So you've been in turkey purgatory now for about a week, right, Patrick?
Yeah, it's actually divided into 2 weeks. There's the wholesale week, which mm-hmm. the stuff goes out mostly in cases, and then there's the internet sale week, which is more, you know, for people who have ordered, you know, for their home.
An individual. So each turkey gets packaged and tagged and weighed and shipped.
And comes with a traceability label, you mm-hmm. know, and an animal welfare approved sticker, you know, it's one of the only poultry farms, if not the only, to have that.
This is Good Shepherd, right?
Yeah, Good Shepherd Turkey Ranch. Frank Reese, the master turkey man.
Well, we're gonna invite Frank on next week to talk about the turkey season, like how it treated him and what he does the rest of the year.
A post-mortem, exactly. Well, yeah. You know, people always think that the entire flock dies, but a large percentage of the flock, maybe like 20%, are kept on as breeders
for
the next generation. And therein lies Frank's greatest skill, you know, the ability to know which toms and which hens to keep back to kind of better the line, you know.
Uh-huh. So he's like all like anyone who is involved in animal husbandry now, he's keeping track of the genetics of his animals.
And mostly he just knows how to look at which one is like has the best traits, you know, for making its own, you know, adding nuances, you know, mm-hmm. to the breed, but also playing up their strong suits.
Sure. Well, what we were talking about, Patrick, you know, how the government policy can support certain elements of industrial ag while moving it towards a better model, and what we think the chances are of that. And Michael was talking about the Health Bucks program. Do you think that poultry producers like Frank are going to be interested in supporting something like that in order to support their own agricultural models, or is that going to like somehow rock their economic boat? I mean, I'm not quite sure where I'm going with that. But
Frank just wants to stay afloat, you know, like all other poultry producers. You know, they even dream one day of like making a profit, you know, being able to put some money aside, you know, like without barely scraping by. It's funny how low expectations we have, Americans have, for what farmers deserve. You know, they're like, they should barely be able to scrape by. I can't believe you charge me 8 more cents for that than I can get that at a supermarket, you know. So I just think that, you know, Frank supports any way of getting paid.
Yes.
And I think that the government action in Frank's case should be, you know, rather than being the USDA being so difficult with slaughterhouses and having so many, like, double sets of rules, you know, for big guys versus little guys, you know, the amount of paperwork they do, you know, they really, it makes it hard to be a slaughterhouse. And the USDA, I think, doesn't always have the easiest reputation with those slaughterhouses. So perhaps maybe government money could go to the USDA opening a model slaughterhouse that actually slaughters for, you know, they should actually be proactive and be the model, you know, so that other people can copy it, rather than, you know, encouraging people not to get into the business, you know, and just let the big guys do it. So I don't know if government money would ever go to opening abattoirs, but it's an interesting idea.
It is an interesting idea because, I mean, one of the things that you read a lot about when you read about the meat industry, especially the inside trade, you know, inside the trade journals, is that, you know, a lot of the rules and regulations that are imposed are economically unfeasible for smaller producers. And that's, you know, Frank obviously falls into that category. So let's talk for a minute about that, about those problems. Michael, I can tell you got something to say.
Right. You know, there's a difference between an anonymous distribution system and one where there's traceability, and the policies for both need to be different and reflect the nature of how the product is grown and then how it's distributed. And I think it's important that any regulations, whether it's FDA or USDA or whatever the, you know, agency is that's going to administer these programs, they need to recognize that there's a difference and that what they should foster the one rather than the other.
Rather than making blanket regulations that do not apply to smaller entities.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and there are proposed regulations that are coming down the pipeline that make many of us nervous. I'm not jumping on tables screaming terrified that it's going to destroy organic agriculture, because I don't think that that's true. And I think there are some great organizations out there who are educating and advocating about these issues. But again, I do think, and this is where I think some of the new appointments hopefully where I think she can make a difference, and where we might see for the first time that there is recognition that there are different types of agriculture out there.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that interested me on Meeting Place recently, I read meetingplace.com religiously. And one of the things that really struck me was a few weeks ago, maybe 10 days ago, there was an article that suggested, actually didn't suggest, it reported that most of the E. coli outbreaks, most E. coli bacteria is coming from this confined area feeding operations. Now, it's not that we didn't know that already, but it was the first time in 2.5 years of reading this blog that I have ever seen it supported by scientific data. Right. And, you know, of course, the response was really negative. There's only a few people that are kind of, you know, normal in there. But it was the first time that they were willing to acknowledge in print that it's really the big slaughterhouses, the big confined area feeding operations, and by extension, the huge oversized poultry farms like Tyson's that are responsible for a lot of the contamination in the food chain. So people like Frank, is not running that kind of operation. And like you say, Michael, he should not be subject to the same regulations, I think.
There should be more options available. I mean, little farmers actually have a fair amount of options. I mean, all the slaughterhouses that kill deer during deer season and, you know, a cow, yes, you might have to drive a little bit more than you'd like. But, I mean, if you're just looking for a state-inspected slaughterhouse, they're a lot easier to find. I mean, there's not necessarily a slaughterhouse shortage, but there's an absolute shortage of slaughterhouses for those types of people wanting to go, you know, mainstream a little bit, you know, even on the smallest level. Even just something as simple as a wholesale distribution chain, mm-hmm. rather than just a retail one. That second tier can never exist, you know, without slaughterhouses being willing to grow and do that. So that's the real bottleneck, is the slaughterhouse that can turn an individual into a group and move a lot of product each week.
So once again, it comes back down to the not just the slaughterhouse, but also, as you said, Patrick, the distribution network, how these people both get their animals to the abattoir and then how they get them out of it and into the market. And I think that's, you know, distribution is really one of the biggest pieces of the puzzle, which hardly anybody talks about. It's like the little secret, you know, under the table there about why we don't. I mean, it's the same thing with farmers, right, Michael? I mean, you can't, if a farmer doesn't have any means of getting his stuff to market, then, you know, he has a very limited amount of people who can buy his product. I mean,
there's no question. And it's not easy. Like, you know, obviously we're in the business of operating farmers markets. Farmers markets alone are not the solution. And it's not easy to come wake up at what, 2-3 in the morning.
Yeah, right.
Drive down. Load
your truck.
Yeah, 17-hour day.
Spend down, you know, right. For 9-plus months. I mean, that's, talk about sustain. That is not sustainable.
Right.
And yet it's, right now, in many ways, it's the best way for the farmer to get the best price for their product, unless they have an efficient distribution system in place, or the convenience of, you know, if we're talking about livestock, having a slaughterhouse or processing facility close by, because again, if you have to travel 2 or 3 hours to get your animals slaughtered, it's going to add to the cost of that product.
Oh, no question.
And
well, especially if you have more than one. I mean, if you have a small herd of cattle and you want to slaughter 25 cattle, how do you get them to the abattoir if you don't have a distributor who's, you know, or a processor who's making that happen for you?
That's right. And who on their end is honest and doing a good job.
Yeah, right.
Which is a big problem.
Doing a good job is a really big problem. Jack is telling us we have 2 more minutes with this segment. Patrick, are you still there?
Yeah, well, I'll just say, you know, the Turkey Project went really well. Frank Reese and Danny Williams did a fantastic job. They processed about 9,000 birds, most of which are going out this Thanksgiving. And they survived the closing of their slaughterhouse, Norbest. Closed, and they had to react and find different slaughterhouses, which they did. So, you know, it was a tough year, but one that ended well. And now it's just a matter of people cooking their turkey. So remember, don't overcook a heritage turkey.
Yes, don't.
Equalizer, right.
Yeah, use a meat thermometer if you need to. And make sure there's plenty of aromatics inside.
165 is what USDA recommends.
Yeah, but not for heritage.
We work with. The chefs we work with recommend like 10 degrees less. Mm-hmm. All right, well, I'm signing out. Thanks for having me on, Katie. You're very generous to re-invite me.
Well, I can't wait for you to get back. Gee whiz. This has been 3 weeks.
Okay, safe travels.
I'll see you in person next time, or I'll see you at the farmer's market there by McCarran Park.
Perfect.
And I'll see you at my house on Friday for lunch.
Ooh, very good. All right.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Have a very safe trip home, Patrick. Yeah, Patrick's coming up to Wakefield, Rhode Island, which is where I'm from. And he and his friend Anne are staying in a local and very charming old inn, which was once owned by my great-grandfather. And so they're going to come over for lunch on Friday after Thanksgiving. I can't wait.
Leftovers.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, well, we have, you and I have, you, the three of us have another 15-minute segment, right, Jack? And so let's go back to this whole question of how, let's talk a little bit about price supports from the government and what the impact that that has on agriculture in general and why it is that we can't get those same price supports for smaller scale farmers. I think that's an interesting little topic. And then let's talk a little bit about the various organizations that are all doing sort of the same thing and yet somehow are not meeting in the middle.
Sure.
Okay, so let's start with the price support thing, because that's something that has always been very perplexing to me, quite frankly. We support artificially high prices for certain crops, mm-hmm. and we don't support prices for other crops. For instance, we apparently have stopped supporting dairy prices, and we've allowed the milk market to almost fail this year.
Yeah.
Because we import so much milk that's cheaper than ours.
Right.
And how come other countries are able to grow milk, or, you know, milk great dairy cows at such a lower rate? Or is it just that
I got to tell you, you're asking
that they're getting ripped off
on that one. You're asking the wrong person.
Okay. Well, actually that's another whole show, because I think that's a really interesting question. The whole dairy industry, I think, is a very knotty problem, because for a long time, the government did support milk prices in this country.
Right.
And that, I guess, went away when?
90s?
Uh-huh.
I don't even know. I'm not your dairy expert.
Okay.
So I'm not going to take. I'm not even going to take a stab.
We'll move away from dairy.
But
and
I'll talk to you about price supports.
Price supports in general. Yeah.
This is again where some of my math might get fuzzy, but you'll get the gist, and I think the listeners will as well. I think 70% of the subsidies go to 5 states.
Right, Iowa, Nebraska. The big grain states.
Uh-huh. Ohio, Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
Iowa.
Wisconsin's a big dairy state.
I know. What are the I think the politics are somewhat obvious of why those states matter and why politicians are afraid to change it. I thought this was the Farm Bill where we had one of the best opportunities to make some changes.
Yes, and nothing happened.
And it's why food is not a Democratic or a Republican issue.
Right.
It's a political issue. And again, you know, we talked before about that there needs to be more money for research and development around sustainable agricultural practices. And what's it going to take to, you know, maybe it is a change in the healthcare policy and economics. I will say, I think that we're having conversations today that never took place 10 years ago.
Most definitely.
And this ties into also the organizations working together here in the city.
Yeah.
I mean, there really are conversations that are taking place that have never taken place. And I'm not an optimist by nature, and I'm also not a conspiracy theorist by nature. But I'm somewhere in the middle. I'm a realist. And I know that someone asked me what are your two greatest challenges, and our two greatest challenges are subsidies and advertising. Mm. Right? Because the food that's being subsidized, then those businesses have the advertising dollars.
That's right.
And we're talking in the billions, if not the hundreds of billions. And how can you change the way people think and eat? And, you know,
without a public education program.
And I'll
tell
you something.
Advertising.
When I told you I don't know the answer about that, I'm no dairy expert. I'm also not the expert. I don't know the answer. You know, I've debated people whether or not Walmart selling organics is a good thing or a bad thing. Right, because what kind of organics is it? Or imported organics, where there's absolutely no organic standard, and then that's everything gets watered down, Or does it mean that Walmart, like Liz's parents now are talking about organics in their communities, and 2 years ago they had no idea what that even meant.
Right.
You have to go to Walmart if you want organic food in your community.
I mean, that's right. That's scary to me.
Yeah.
Very scary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So back to, I guess, the question at first was about price supports. And again, I think that any government policy that makes it cheaper to buy a bag of potato chips than to buy a potato is flawed. And ultimately, again, we're getting hammered on all sides. So you get hammered, you're paying people up front to produce unhealthy food. Then you're paying, as the government, to clean up environmentally the damage that's caused by that. And then you have the physical damage that's caused by that, and why there is an obesity and diabetes epidemic in our country. And on top of that, you talk about community degradation in terms of a real infrastructure. If their people aren't healthy and all of your business and none of your businesses are local, then the dollar gets drained from the community. There's no community in investment. And so it would only make sense for a government to invest in policies that are on the to the counter of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what we're doing. And again, maybe it's this an education of both the populace and the politicians themselves.
I think politicians don't know a damn thing.
No,
is the problem.
They don't get, really they don't get food.
People. Yeah.
They are. Food has never been on the radar.
Yeah.
And
it's sort of the way doctors did not take into account the impact of nutrition on their patients until only, about 10 years ago.
Right.
Before that, nobody ever talked about whether or not you had a healthy diet. Just wasn't on the table.
That's right. And what they might define as being a healthy diet
right.
will depend on how much the doctor understands about food.
Yeah.
Because you can have a nutrition chart, and I'm sorry, but if what you're putting into your body is protein that's been raised, pumped up with all kinds of nasty stuff, you're not healthy.
Right.
And that trickles down. So my expertise is on... We'll say that it is irresponsible for our government to invest in policies that make us less healthy on all levels.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it.
And I do think that the government has an opportunity. I'll tell you, Chris Quinn, the Speaker of City Council,
yeah,
has been a champion in this city of supporting healthy food and access to food. And there are other politicians like her in the city who are starting to get it.
Scott Stringer has
Scott Stringer
sponsored several of these incredible panels. I got shut out. I got a notice about it. It's coming up in December, this big thing.
It's powwow at
NYU. I was like, oh yeah, I want to go. Sold out like the day after it was announced.
That's right.
I was amazed.
His Columbia one did the same thing.
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And he really is looking at how government can play a role, whether it's through providing food, EBT terminals to farmers market operators, or helping to crack the nut on what a distribution system would look like, or how we can create tax incentives for healthy food stores to spring up in any community, let alone communities that disproportionately lack access to healthy foods. There's no question about it. City Council has really, our food stamp program, our food stamp and farmers market program, has grown from $987 in 2005 to over $250,000 this year.
Wow.
And that is because the New York City Council, led and Speaker Quinn in particular, has invested in that project. And most of what they've invested in was an education campaign to let people know that you can use food stamps at farmers markets. Prior to 2006, in the history of the state of New York, there was no public awareness campaign that farmers markets could accept food stamps. And it is crucial. I mean, we've grown. You see what the growth that's happened in 4 years. And this isn't even the tip of the $1 billion that are $857 million that are available in food stamps in New York City,
mm-hmm.
with just a 60% enrollment in the program. So government can make significant, have a significant impact on the health and wellness of communities.
By investing in public education, almost.
That's exactly right. And talk about public education. The New York City school system is the second largest distributor in the world of food, only to the United States military.
Wow.
So if you talk about,
Michael,
and we know that when you provide young people with healthy food and let them know what good food tastes like, it changes their eating habits.
Yes, it does.
Long term.
Well, I had a little interview with Bill Telepan a few weeks ago because he's working with
doing wellness in the schools. Yeah. What he's doing is amazing.
Fantastic. And really, and we also had Ann Cooper on, the lunch lady.
Sure.
Who has, been behind this for about 15 years, a real unsung hero of changing the nutrition policies in school systems. But there's also the Child Nutrition Act, which is coming up for the vote, which people should be aware of. And should be aware of where their local politician
is. Slow Food is doing a ton of outreach about the child
nutrition. But everybody should be looking up the Child Nutrition Act and finding out where their local politician falls on voting on that act. Because even if it's you add 15 cents on the dollar, to you're going to make an enormous change in the way schools or educational institutions are able to source their food.
Right. That's exactly
because right now kids are only getting, according to Bill, 94 cents out of a $2.97 subsidy.
Right.
In other words, it costs $2.97 to feed kids, out of which only 94 cents goes to the actual child in terms of the food products.
The rest goes to labor.
The rest of it is labor,
infrastructure, overhead.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
So that's, that extra 10 cents means the difference between buying more fresh fruits and vegetables or not.
That's right.
Or buying better quality meats. I mean, if you're going to want your kid to eat, a chicken something, you'd rather have a chicken burrito that's shredded fresh chicken instead of a chicken McNugget, which
is
what
they're getting
now.
Deep fried.
Yeah.
Right. That's exactly right.
Right. And that has been ground up. People don't even realize how they make chicken McNuggets. It's ground up chicken bits. Basically, it's
parts is parts. Remember that commercial?
Yeah, that's right. It's like it's the equivalent of bench trim. What industrialized hamburger comes from is bench trim, and what chicken McNuggets come from is the equivalent in the poultry industry. And it's basically ground up, reconstituted with a lot of fillers and tons of salt.
Right.
So this is I know, right? You cringe when you think about it. This is what you're giving your children.
What's scary is it tastes really good.
Yeah, sure. It's salty.
Yeah.
We're programmed to love salt and fat, as my next guest will attest. Andy Smith, the food historian, is going to come back and talk about why we eat what we eat for Thanksgiving. So that should be an interesting next hour. But in any case, Jack, am I supposed to be wrapping this up? Liz, you have not said a single thing about all the sort of programs and events and things that are coming up. So let's just dial it back to that.
Sure.
To the here and now for what's going on in the green market.
A lot of our markets are closing down this week and a few more staying open, like Michael said, through Christmas. So after Christmas, we only have about 19 markets that are open
until
April. And
that's all listed on your website.
Right.
So
everything's listed.
Figure out whether...
So managers are really, saying goodbye to customers and thanking them for a great season. And then we're, doing a lot of Thanksgiving stuff in Union Square. And then for the winter, we take a little bit of a break, but we hold our Educated Eater panel series. We're working with the 92nd Street Y in Tribeca. We did one about generational farming a couple months ago and had, fathers and sons who were farming together up on that panel. And the ones we have coming up are sustainable fishing and seafood practices. So
I'm excited about that.
And also have some vintners coming in and some wine grape growers from Long Island and the Finger Lakes region, youth in agriculture, women in agriculture. So these are some of the panel series that we have coming up. They're $5 is the best deal.
That's
in town. We have snacks
to really
there.
Learn about what's happening in our food system locally as well as nationally. These panels are a great source of information.
They are. And I'll tell you about the seafood. Internally at Green Market, we really have our own questions. Mm-hmm. And we know that there are products being... we get an email once a month saying, why is there swordfish being sold at your market? How is it possible that flounder is sustainable and being sold at your market?
Right.
And we have our answers. And... I think that it's a neat opportunity to educate both ourselves and the public around what's going on with enforcement around fishing in our region. There's a difference between small scale fishing and industrial fishing and the impact that it has.
I think people need to hear what the gear is.
That's right. And we also might find there are things that are being sold in our markets that probably shouldn't be sold there.
The best thing to sell.
And that's okay too. And that it's all a process. And this, through these Educated Eaters panel series, is how I think we'll be able to figure some of that out. And I think it sounds great.
There's definitely a hunger for it. I mean, one of our panel series last winter, we sold out 70 tickets and still 30 people were waiting in line. And we finally just let them in and they all stood in the back for 2 hours and listened to this panel. I couldn't believe it. Yeah. So, yeah, people are interested and, concerned. So we're here to be a resource for them.
Well, let me ask you one final question because I think we have to wrap it up now. But I'm struck by the interest, which I think that even as recently as 2 years ago or 3 years ago really did not exist. And I think a lot of it has to do with Michael Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma. Yes. I suspect that that was really the sort of stick of dynamite that blew
the top off the barrel. I hold volunteer trainings and I let everybody say hi. And two or three people each one says, well, I read Omnivore's Dilemma and I just got interested, so I'm here. I mean, all the time.
I'm amazed at the impact that book had.
Yeah.
It certainly had an impact on me and I was very late to the table reading it. I mean, I was already interested in the industry, but...
Right. No, what he has done is he has been able, in a very simple way, in an entertaining way, and in a non-judgmental, preachy way, explain that your food choices matter, and this is what's going on in the food world out there. I mean, I think most people had no clue, absolutely none, about how food is produced.
Yeah,
and again, he says in a simple way, and in a non-judgmental way, even saying, "Hey, I ate the nuggets."
Sure,
you know. Knowing what the consequences of my decision was. Mm-hmm. And there's no question what he has done to catapult this issue in the general public. And I'll tell you something else. Our health got caught up to us.
Yeah.
The years and years of eating food that's killing us at the same time as Michael Pollan talking about this became a national health issue.
Yeah.
And policy, you can't ignore it anymore.
It was sort of the perfect storm of a publication, a public relations effort, and sort of the national crisis.
And, you know,
over
all we're trying to do is going back to the way it was.
I know.
Dial it back
50, 60 years.
That's just it. It's everywhere, and it almost seems like people are jumping on a bandwagon, but for us, it's not a trend. It's just the place where you go to get the best food, you know?
Right.
Get the highest quality, most affordable
food. Well, it's an interesting comment on American society that the thing that we spend the least amount of our post-tax dollars is on food, whereas in other countries, it's about a quarter of your income. Here, it's about maybe 3-4%.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think that kind of says it all. So I guess we have to wrap it up. Jack is like signaling to me. Michael Hurwitz from Director of Green Market and Liz Carolla. Thanks for having us.
This is
a really fun hour, you guys.
Yeah, we like it.
We're going to do this again.
We love it.
We love to talk about politics.
Drink beer with you on Sundays.
Should it not be different soon? Dancing over sun-soaked sand.